Welcome to Come and See, your podcast for finding truth in a world of chaos. Brought to you by Living Waters Abide Ministries. With host and founder, Richard Case, and co-host and retreat leader, Kathy Riccone. Jesus reminds us to watch for the signs of his return. Today, we will explore further what we are seeing in our times that line up with what signs he said would indicate the potential of the end and his return. We will also discuss the practical meaning of this as we watch and as a remnant prepare as he so leads. And now your host, Richard Case.
Well, good morning, everybody. This is End Times Friday, and we are very excited. This is a very special broadcast. We have our good friend Eric, who has been out sailing today. Eric, when we come over, we're just gonna have a trip to schedule to come and see you guys and have you guys lead
exactly.
us.
Exactly.
And I love sailing, so I would love to go in the Mediterranean. That'd be fun. And then Rabbi just said he was all night on a overnight
desert
trek
hike
in the desert.
A hike, right?
Desert hike. Yeah, that you were a tour guide on. Now, is it purposely done overnight so like you actually have to stay awake and do your stuff at night? Is that what you guys do?
I think one of the main reasons it's at night is because the desert is a lot of the year is too hot during the day to do a long trek. So this way, even in the summer, you can do long hikes in the desert without frying.
You said you ride camels, right?
Not this time, no. Sometimes you bump into wild camels out in the desert, but we didn't last night, just scorpions.
Okay. Well, so anyway, from the last time we were in, we were, interesting enough, we were talking about Iran, that Trump was trying to negotiate a settlement on the nuclear. You predicted correctly, Iran's not going to agree to anything. That leaves you in a position where you have to take action. You can't allow a nuclear weapon to be developed as a threat to your existential existence. And there was a thought on your part that Trump probably would drop what they call the bunker busters, but you had other ways of doing it. But he did, you know. So the first question, what happened? What's happening since? How is Israel looking at all this right now, given what did happen with Trump and Iran?
Well, I think first and foremost, the country overall is very grateful that President Trump followed through on sort of his threats and commitments and did what he could, or I guess the U.S. Air Force did what it could to destroy the nuclear facilities from the air. So that I think the country is extremely grateful. I think that there's a bit of a sigh of relief across the country here. There's been this sort of Damocles sword, like at our necks, and no one here believes that it's totally gone. But at least the timing has been pushed out for anywhere between 6 months to 3 or 4 years, depending upon what actually happened in Iran, which probably the Mossad has the best idea, but they're not talking publicly about exactly what were the net results of the destruction in Iran. I'm not even sure the Iranians fully know or appreciate just what's been destroyed because they were in denial for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if and when we're really going to know what truly happened and the details of what got destroyed or what hasn't. First and foremost, at this stage, everyone would love to know where that, 400 kilograms of enriched uranium is in Iran. There are probably only a handful of people in Iran that know, and whoever at Mossad has been tracking this. So I'm not sure we'll ever really know, at least not for a long time. So there's a bit of a feeling of relief, and I think a great deal of pride in what the Israeli Defense Forces, especially the Air Force, and the Mossad together were able to achieve. It's sort of mind-boggling when you add it all up together. The details of the missions that the Mossad conducted in Iran, for the years prior to the launch of the attack, days before the attack, hours before the attack, is really mind-boggling, what they were able to achieve in terms of a penetration of the Iranian system. Nuclear system and their research facilities and their government and so on. So I think I don't know. That's, I think there's a bit of a sigh of relief here for a brief period of time. And I think there's a general recognition that this is going to change greatly the dynamics of the Middle East. I'm not sure all of us know exactly how that's going to happen. But when a mission like this is conducted in this way, with the effectiveness that it took place, everyone in the Middle East is going to take notice. And I think that President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu are busy doing what they can to try to capitalize on this new dynamic and reaching additional agreements and reaching a deal in Gaza and so on. And I'm not sure anyone here really knows what's going to unfold. And I'm not sure anyone here really knows or trusts what's getting said in Washington anymore, because, you know, those two gentlemen deceived the world quite effectively in how they handled things prior to the Iranian attack.
Yeah. When you made a statement that, the carried out mission, from what you have understood there, what exactly has been, let's say, accomplished with the military leadership of Iran, the military sites in Iran, and then you said the nuclear facilities. The reports we have over here, by the way, is it goes all the way from they didn't really damage that much and they moved everything ahead of time to complete obliteration. So we don't know.
So neither one are correct. But I'm not an authority and don't have the information to know exactly where the line should be drawn. From what I can gather now, bear in mind, I'm also a scientist, and I'm a chemist and physicist from UC Berkeley, and a lot of the Manhattan Project was conducted at UC Berkeley, and so I have some understanding of what it takes to make a bomb of this nature. So there were three nuclear facilities that were the focus of everyone's attention, and I'll start with one called Isfahan. So Isfahan is in the southwestern part of Iran, and it had mostly above ground, although there's one facility that's below ground. And what they were doing there was they would take raw uranium ore and they would oxidize it into what is called uranium yellow cake. And it's called yellow cake because it literally looks yellow. And it's a solid form of uranium. It's a way of purifying uranium. But uranium, to make a bomb, needs to be, you need a certain isotope that's found like only 3% of the atoms of uranium in nature. So you need to enrich it. It's called isotope enrichment. So it's actually less than 3%. It's like 1%. And the way that that's typically done is you take the uranium yellow cake and you reduce it to form a gas. And the only form of gas that uranium takes is uranium hexafluoride. So they have to take it to relatively higher temperatures, and the uranium hexafluoride is reduced. Uranium cake is reduced to uranium hexafluoride. And then they compress it, and then they take it to their centrifuges. And the centrifuges are really mechanical devices that spin at high RPM. And if you've ever been to a doctor's office or whatever, where they separate out your blood, and so on, this is a centrifuge. But that one separates liquids, not gases. Gases are much more difficult to separate the isotope in their weight of stuff. So literally what happens is the thing spins, the heavier atoms, which are uranium-238, spin to the perimeter of the cylinder, leaving the small amount of uranium-235. And you need to take this through many, many, many stages to make enriched uranium. So at Isfahan, they had the facility. It was the only facility, I think, that was talked about where they could actually take the uranium ore, convert it to uranium hexafluoride, and then they would take the uranium hexafluoride that eventually got enriched, and then they would reduce it back into uranium metal. And the uranium metal at something more than 90% is the basic ingredient of the bomb. And Isfahan was largely destroyed. All the facilities for making the yellow cake have to be rebuilt from scratch. All the facilities for converting the uranium hexafluoride have to be redone from scratch. So even if they have this 60% enriched uranium and they can get to it, under best cases from Iran's perspective, it's buried under rubble. If we're fortunate enough, maybe it's not radioactive, okay? So it's not a harm to human beings, but maybe it was even opened or scattered, who knows what, if we're lucky. We don't really know. Although I'm sure there's some people who do know. So even if you have the centrifuges, which they don't, you don't have the ability to be able to process the uranium through its complete cycle. Now, in Natanz, which Israel hit it on its own, where they had the original sets of centrifuges, and bear in mind, it takes like a whole battery of these things, thousands of these centrifuges connected in series to each other, a vacuum hose connected between them, because you go from one stage to the next, to eventually get it enriched.
Yeah.
And so in Natanz, to the best of our understanding, was pretty much destroyed. And listeners also need to know that these, because these centrifuges spin at very high RPM, they're like on ball bearings. And people who are familiar with ball bearings know that it doesn't take a lot of damage to cause them to be dysfunctional and to spin out of control. And so you may not even need to destroy with a bomb and do a direct hit, but just coming nearby and shaking things up so much that these ball bearings go haywire may be enough.
Yeah.
So I think people are pretty confident that this Natanz facility was pretty much taken out, which was the one where they really needed the U.S. help because they needed those very penetrating bombs dropped from the B-2 bombers that Israel doesn't have. The alternative Israel had, by the way, was to actually put special forces on the ground at Fordo to go into the facility and blow it up from the inside. And that's what they did in Syria. But that was a high-risk operation that was only like a last resort. At Fordo, it's not really known how much damage was done. Those people who say it's just a matter of months have no idea what they're talking. Okay, they're talking nonsense, because this is one of the unfortunate things, I think, in the Israeli and in the U.S. military and CIA and defense intelligence, that it's been politicized and you can no longer rely on what you're hearing from these organizations. And we saw it here in Israel, and unfortunately, thank God, hopefully it hasn't happened in Israel yet. And if it does, it's really going to be bad for everybody. But in any case, taking the politics aside, the Iranian nuclear effort to create a bomb has been set back a long time. I can't tell you if it's years or months, or if it's, you know, 6 months or several years, but it's more than a few months, and that's for sure. Because besides these three facilities, the IDF took out the facilities which built the centrifuges, the facilities that were used for the processing of the uranium, the facilities used for making the trigger necessary to make the bomb. When I was a graduate student at UC Berkeley, these triggers were very hard to get. I had to use one for my research. It wasn't nuclear related. It was something totally, it was laser related. But these switches that are used to ignite a chain reaction are very difficult to get. Iran, I don't think, could build them themselves. They're going to have to buy them on the market someplace, which is the other thing that people don't understand or seem to appreciate. For Iran to rebuild all this stuff, some stuff they have inside their own country and they have the capabilities, but all those factories have been destroyed. So they have to rebuild those factories to rebuild the centrifuges. And not everything is totally 100% indigenous. They need to go out and buy stuff on the open market. Many of those centrifuges were, parts for them were supplied by Siemens, a large German defense contractor. Now, will Germany allow that happen again? I doubt it. But, you know, that doesn't mean that they can't find it on the black market somewhere. But all these things take time. They're just not going to be able to go down to their local supermarket and take one off the shelf. Okay. They're going to need to, you know, be putting agents in place and scrambling to go get this stuff. And it's not going to happen in a week. It's going to take them a while. And I think in the interim, I think it was the hope, I'm not sure it'll happen, that from both the Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump, that everyone would go back to the negotiating table. And now we'll negotiate a real deal where, you know, Iran will not have any enrichment capability. But it's not at all clear now that Iran is even interested in talking anymore. So
we'll come back to talking about what's next. And Rabbi, based on what Eric has said there, what's the sense from the population, the general population of Israel? What are they sensing now? Do they, Eric said, a sense of relief? You know, what else are they feeling or thinking?
Oh, yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think that there was a huge sense of relief. I felt that because Israel's Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders have been talking for years about the threat of the Iranian nuclear capability. Nothing was ever done. And a lot of us, just were thinking, well, they're never going to do anything because the condo, you know, and originally, just like, you know, to back up, like one of the big reasons why we didn't take action was because we were afraid of the reaction from Hamas bombarding Israel with millions of missiles, Hezbollah from Lebanon, who were working in, you know, in coordination with Iran. They were proxies of Iran. So they had tens of thousands of missiles that they would have unleashed on the civilians, every single city in Israel. And so there were going to be, you know, in addition to Iran's reaction against any attacks. So it was a pretty formidable equation, you know, to look at. And the consequences could have been extreme, you know, extremely, extremely scary. They were scary even as it was, even without Hamas. So the fact that Israel had fairly efficiently neutralized, or to a large extent, Hezbollah, and you know, paved the way for us doing something. But there was a lot of skepticism whether it would ever happen, and you know, our children's future, our grandchildren's future, was all dependent on us taking action. So there was a great relief that we actually went about doing it. At the same time, it was crazy. You know, it was really crazy to live during that 12-day war. I mean, they were targeting, you know, daily, sometimes hundreds of times a day, ballistic missiles the size of buses that were going up in, you know, into the atmosphere and coming down at lightning speed. They were targeting civilians in every single city in the country, sometimes, as I said, hundreds of times a day. And no one was sleeping. Everyone was running to shelters. Like, virtually everyone in the country was running to shelters several times a day in the middle of the night with their kids. And, you know, with real fear that this one's going to hit me, this is going to hit nearby. You probably saw, like, you know, even one of those things was destroying like 8-10 apartment buildings, neighborhoods with one bomb. And so it was extremely stressful, extremely scary. No one was functioning. No one was going to work. The kids were not going to school. It was crazy. And I don't think many countries, you know, could have even like psychologically handled that. There was a tremendous bravery, and but everyone felt, you know, it was worth it. You know, this is what we had to go through this eventually, and this is necessary for our security, and hopefully it won't last too long and not be too much. And of course, you know, many people did die. There was tremendous destruction, and many people did die. So it was really scary to go through it, and we were going through it being completely exhausted. Oh, and every minute that you weren't exhausted and running to the shelter, you were looking at the news, like you just glued to what's going on every second, both with us attacking them and them attacking us. So it was just like tremendous intensity. And then when it finished, we all just collapsed, you know, and okay, life back to normal. Well, why do I feel like I need to sleep for the next week?
Right.
But so yeah, so it was really, but you know, we're very, very relieved. And I want to add also just like the fact that Israel was able to achieve complete aerial dominance over Iran and basically just take out any target was also a gigantic success, you know, also paved the way for the United States. And I would imagine that makes Iran think twice about, you know, rebuilding, because we can, I assume, just do that again, you know, and is it worth investing billions of dollars at great risk? And then Israel's just going to like wipe them out again. So I imagine that also makes them think twice. And it also brings, you know, Israel's sense of, you know, strategic intelligence and power definitely lends itself to good partnerships in the Middle East.
Now, we've actually...
If I can add a couple things?
Yeah, go ahead.
So there's like a couple more things to what Ephraim said. As your listeners may remember, earlier in the Gaza war and in Lebanon, Israel was attacked by Iran by like a barrage of 100 missiles. And the U.S. Military stationed in the Middle East assisted Israel in taking most of those out. And when Israel attacked sort of in response, it already had taken out most of Iran's aerial defenses. Now, the Israeli Air Force had trained over the years to be able to handle the anti-missile batteries. They're called surface-to-air missiles, SAMs. Yep. People with long memories, like with gray hair like me, may remember from the Vietnam War talking about SAM missiles, and those were Russian-built anti-aircraft missiles. And Iran had a more recent version of those, and they were neutralized by the Israeli Air Force. Now, the Israeli jets that were purchased from U.S. contractors and modified by Israel really didn't have a problem with those defense systems. They had ways of maneuvering around them. But the reason they needed to take those defense systems out was there were drones. I mean, hundreds of Israeli drones that were launched from Israel, traversed across Syria, and were operating 24 hours a day inside Iran. Most of the missile launches that would attack Israel from Iran happened at night. And the reason they happened at night was because it takes a certain amount of time to load these missiles with the solid rocket fuel. Not as much as liquid, but it takes a while. And if you do it during the day, they can be spotted by satellites or by these drones operating, and these drones would take them out. At night, they were much more difficult to operate, to notice, until they actually launched. So that was one thing I wanted to add, was why these anti-aircraft systems. I think it's been announced that Iran's discussing with China purchasing their anti-missile systems, but my guess is they won't be much more effective. I don't know. There's also reports in the press that Iran is going to be buying jets from China. Our understanding is that China is no big friend of Iran, but if they can make a buck, they're going to make a buck, and this is what they're going to do. Okay. On a related subject, there was a very well-publicized comment attributed to President Vladimir Putin in his discussions with the Spanish prime minister several years ago, when the Spanish prime minister asked Putin, why in the hell are you selling anti-aircraft missiles to Iran? He says, oh, you don't need to worry. The Israelis are going to take them out on the first day of attack anyway. So it's just a way to make money. He's quoted saying that. And the other thing that I wanted to add to what Brian was saying was the significance of the changes in Syria. In order for Israel to reach Iranian airspace, it has to cross Syrian airspace. And if Syria had, if you remember, was a proxy of Iran, and it could be very ugly things, and it also had these anti-aircraft missiles, so sending drones across Syria to Iran would have been very difficult. But because it's like everything was aligned at the right time, at the right place to launch this 12-day war. We had, you know, Hezbollah neutralized. Syria was basically not only neutralized, the current president of Syria, Shirah, I guess is his name, or Jolani, actually announced that Israel's welcome to use Syrian airspace to attack Iran. He hates Iran now, too, because Iran took over his country for so long. And so that was a very, very important element into the timing and why now and so on. So it wasn't clear to many people when all these stars in the constellation would align once again for all these things to come together at the right time and place to launch an attack.
And as we end this section, Rabbi, a question that based on what Eric just said, do the people think about process that because of what has happened, with, you know, that the October 7th that started this whole thing, with then Hamas being neutralized, Hezbollah being neutralized, Syria being neutralized and changing, allow you to do what you had to do in Iran, but it was all lined up. Do they see God at work in that? Do they talk about that, or do they just say, yeah, that was lucky?
Yeah, well, yeah, most of us, I believe, see God in that, and it's really, really a crazy story, because there's the Purim holiday.
Yeah.
One of our holidays is Purim, where Haman in the Persian Empire about 2,500 years ago, they were determined to commit a genocide against all the Jewish people. And there's an expression which is used in the scroll of Esther, which says that everything got reversed. They tried to do a complete genocide, and they had all the power. You know, we were a helpless minority in their gigantic empire that was the largest empire in the world. And they just said, we're going to kill you all. And we switched that over. And in the end of the story, not only were we more powerful, but all our enemies had been killed. So they say, like, it was just a complete upside down reversal of fortune. So a lot of us definitely saw that. October 7th was seen by our enemies, Hamas, as the start. They did it specifically because they really believed, Hamas believed, that if they start this and make such a devastating blow, that their partners, Hezbollah, will join the attack, Iran will join the attack, the Arabs in the West Bank and anywhere else will also join in massive revolutions and terror attacks. and that they really can destroy the entire country. And they believe that they were starting to set that whole thing in motion. And miraculously, that didn't happen. And we started like one by one taking out these existential threats in just such a mind-boggling, miraculous way between the beepers that, you know, killed 4,000 of Hezbollah operatives. And this, like, no one expected that in 12 days Israel could just achieve such complete superiority over Iran, which is many, many, many times its size. And so it really was like a nahafochu, a reversal of fortune. What they thought was going to be the death blow to us ends up leaving us in a much, much more favorable position. And hopefully more good things will happen.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys both for sharing all that. We'll come back, talk more about, you know, what the status is there. And then what do we all think is going to, what do you guys think is going to happen next? So we're so appreciative to actually get real information. And that's why our audience so appreciates it. And they look forward to this so much. So thank you so much. So we're pleased to have you safe. And we are glad that life is at least semi-normal and hopefully gets to be normal. So thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for joining us. It is always a pleasure to have y'all here. And especially this time, I expressed this earlier, and I know many of our listeners, you were in everyone's thoughts and prayers in the midst of all of this. So a big sigh of relief simply to know that you and your families are well. And so thanks for taking the time to express all of this and share it with us. We appreciate it. To our listeners, if you have questions from today's broadcast, send them in to us at questions@abideministries.com. And we look forward to seeing you next time.
Yep, we'll see you then.
Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Come and See, your podcast for truth in a world of chaos. Brought to you by Living Waters Abide Ministries. Send us your questions and comments and tune in tomorrow for more answers to your personal questions about living life in God's truth. Remember, God's will is best and none better. His truth brings peace in this world of chaos.